Coming up this morning on Up to Date, Medicaid expansion, abortion, and legal marijuana. Hear about the big stories of 2020 and get a look at the state of healthcare in Kansas and Missouri. That's coming up on Up to Date this morning at 11. Today's forecast, 37 degrees, sunny skies, a high of 52. Tonight, clear, a low of 28. Tomorrow, sunny again and a high of 53 degrees. I'm Linda Scher. Stay with us. Up to Date is coming up next after the day's news.
One of the hottest issues across the country and in Kansas and Missouri this year will be health care. Lots of health-related issues, including Medicaid expansion, are on the table as lawmakers return for another year of lawmaking in our state capitals. Legislators will also make decisions concerning vaping, prescription drug monitoring, abortion, opioids, and nurse practitioners. There's a lot flying around, and as part of KCUR's ongoing State of Kansas City series, we're about to talk about it. With us are the two reporters from KCUR's health team. They are Alex Smith. Alex, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Dan Margulies is also here. Dan, good morning to you.
Hey, Steve.
Let's begin with the issue that some consider to be the granddaddy or grandmama of all the health care issues in our two states, and that's Medicaid expansion. The news out of Kansas these days is practically breathtaking as Republican leaders appear to be on the brink of a compromise with Governor Laura Kelly to pass some sort of Medicaid expansion bill this year. Dan, what's going on out there?
Yeah, for many years, of course, Republicans and the Republican-controlled legislature have opposed, adamantly opposed, Medicaid expansion in Kansas. Kansas is one of just 13 states now left that have not expanded Medicaid.
Along with Missouri, I should point out.
Along with Missouri, indeed. And now Governor Kelly and the Senate Majority Leader, Jim Denning, apparently are in talks to expand Medicaid. Both have confirmed they're talking. If Medicaid is expanded in the state, it would add about 100,000 residents to the Medicaid rolls atop the 400,000 or so that are already on Medicaid, Steve. That would bring it to nearly 500,000 people. I'll remind listeners that under the Affordable Care Act, states have the option of expanding Medicaid to residents earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which amounts to a little more than $26,000 per year for a family of four. The federal government would pick up 90% of the tab and the state the rest.
The talk in Kansas is they're actually close to a compromise here, that there's progress being made in these negotiations that you just mentioned.
Right. Well, Denny unveiled his own plan back in October, which was the first indication we had that there might be a breakthrough in this logjam. And his plan provided for both Medicaid expansion and reinsurance for health plans sold on the ACA marketplace. It's a kind of complicated plan. It's not clear that that's the plan that will ultimately wind up expanding Medicaid in Kansas. But I think hopes are up for the very first time in many years that this can and will get done.
So hope is high in Kansas, Alex Smith. On the Missouri side, maybe not so much, right?
Well, that's right. In Missouri, Medicaid expansion has never really had much traction. I mean, you've had a lot of advocacy groups, hospitals, and Democratic legislators pushing for it, but Republican lawmakers who are in the majority have just really shown zero interest. However, I mean, just in the last year, Governor Parson has appointed a task force to look at reforming Medicaid, and he's indicated that might include expansion, although some critics are skeptical that that would actually happen. But at the same time, advocates have been working to get expansion on the ballot in November for next year, or for this year.
You're saying there's a chance that voters might actually have a chance to pass judgment on Medicaid expansion in Missouri.
That's right. Advocates have been circulating a statewide petition to get expansion on the ballot, and from what I understand, it sounds like they've had a lot of success getting signatures.
So you're saying how many people would Medicaid expansion help again, Dan? You're saying 100,000 in Kansas?
Correct.
How about the number in Missouri? Do we know?
A little over about 300,000 adults in Missouri. Missouri would be eligible.
Missouri, of course, has a much larger population than Kansas.
Let's remind our listeners about the arguments here. Why are supporters so adamant that Medicaid be expanded, Dan, and why are opponents so determined to reject it?
Well, you know, it's not clear to me why, to take up the opponents first, they're so adamantly against it because, as I said before, the government at this point picks up 90% of the tab, and numerous studies have shown that the economic effects, the long-term effects of expansion are greatly beneficial to the states that have done it.
But you do hear that while the federal government promises 90% coverage, some opponents say they'll believe it when they see it 5, 10, 15 years down the road, that money might disappear.
Right, except that the federal government, believe it or not, despite all the anti-government sentiments that are out there, tends not to renege on these kinds of things. And since the ACA went into effect and various states have expanded Medicaid, the federal government has duly made its payments to all those states. There's no reason to believe that it would renege on that at any point.
Proponents then say what, Dan?
So that it's economically beneficial to the states, and obviously that it's going to provide health coverage to thousands and thousands of people who currently don't have it. And that is good for those people, obviously, but more to the point, it's also good for the economy as a whole, and it's certainly good for hospitals who are dealing with large numbers of uninsured patients who simply can't pay the bills.
Let's talk about that, Alex. What would Medicaid expansion do when it comes to boosting the bottom lines of rural hospitals? I can't help but note that, as you two have noted in your State of Kansas City series, that 11 rural hospitals have closed in Missouri and Kansas going back to 2005.
Well, that's right. Hospitals are struggling in a lot of rural areas because they serve a lot of patients who don't make them much money, like insured, uninsured people and people on Medicare. You have those same groups in big cities, but they're balanced out by patients on private insurance which pays hospitals a lot more. These hospitals, the rural hospitals, say that if Medicaid were expanded, then many more of these patients would be able to have health care coverage, and that would make these hospitals on a lot more solid, footing economically. And while that's true, it's not necessarily clear that expansion would actually save these hospitals. I've been to a lot of these hospitals in rural Missouri, and they're very different places than a lot of the hospitals that we have here in Kansas City. And a lot of the changes that have been happening with the economy and with health care, seem to indicate that, a lot of rural hospitals will be going away kind of no matter what happens.
Okay, so great hopes for expansion in Kansas this year, perhaps not in Missouri. Let's move over to abortion. As your story points out, it's on KCUR's website now. Missouri now has but one abortion clinic, and efforts are underway to strip that license away. Dan, any updates on that front?
Yeah, you're talking about this battle over the abortion license for the Planned Parenthood Clinic in St. Louis.
Correct.
The only remaining abortion provider in the entire state, a state consisting of 6 million people. Now, the state has claimed to find numerous safety violations at that clinic, which Planned Parenthood has vehemently denied and says is merely pretextual, part of the anti-abortion agenda of this state's administration, and aimed at shutting down this last abortion provider in the state. That would make Missouri, incidentally, the only state in the entire United States without a legal abortion clinic.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yes. And the current status of that case is it's now before an administrative law judge who has heard evidence already and is likely to decide the case, Steve, in the next month or two. Now, I'm going to add something else here. Beyond that, the state is trying to strip Planned Parenthood clinics of their federal funding. That was part of 2018 budget legislation, which Planned Parenthood has challenged as being unconstitutional under the Missouri Constitution, and also as being discriminatory because it singles out Planned Parenthood over and above other health care providers. Now, that case is before the Missouri Supreme Court, and the court is likely to decide that case in the next few months.
Meantime, in Kansas, Alex, there's this talk that abortion opponents will try for another constitutional amendment. We're talking about one in Missouri, maybe one in Kansas now, to overturn a state Supreme Court ruling that guaranteed women the right to terminate a pregnancy. Do we think that such an amendment could pass? any sense what the polls say? Where are we here?
Well, let me give this one over to Dan. He's
yeah, sure.
This
yeah.
I'd
be happy to talk about that. This comes against the backdrop of last year's ruling, momentous ruling by the Kansas Supreme Court that found a right to abortion in the Kansas Constitution. You recall that ruling. I mean, it had been long awaited. It took 2 years for the court to decide the case, something like that. And it was, I believe, a 5-2 decision mm-hmm. by the court, or 6-1. In any event, a large majority of the court found that way. Now abortion opponents are determined to amend the Constitution to undo that decision by the Kansas Supreme Court. It's not easy to amend the Kansas Constitution. It will require a 2/3 vote of both chambers, the House and the Senate. And then it would be put on the ballot, if that happened, it would be put on the ballot for a majority of the voters to decide.
But the polls suggest that there isn't all that much support for wiping out abortion in the state, unless I'm missing something here.
Right. So this is not going to be an easy hurdle mm-hmm. for abortion opponents to overcome. Even though the Republicans hold a supermajority in both chambers, there are some moderate Republicans who may be critical swing votes here, so they may not get that 2/3 majority that they need to get it on the ballot. And once it's on the ballot, there's no guarantee that a majority of voters will approve such a constitutional amendment.
So bottom line, abortion is going to be a hot topic in Kansas this year.
Very hot topic.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about one of KCUR's ongoing State of Kansas City series stories. We're talking about health care in both Kansas and Missouri, a story that the team of Alex Smith and Dan Margulies will be following closely during this upcoming year. Okay, different topic, gentlemen. Missouri legalized medical marijuana last year. For those who need it, will they be able to access it anytime soon, Alex?
So medical marijuana is legal right now as of 2020, but you can't get it at a dispensary right now. That's because the licensing for businesses has not gone quite on the timetable that was expected. The state is still working to, just review and do the licensing process for dispensaries, and it will probably be, you know, at least a few months, maybe even into the spring or summer, where we'll actually be able to see it at, you know, at retail dispensaries.
And just guessing here, that's causing some frustration out there by folks who say they need medical marijuana for their own medical conditions.
That's right. The last number that I saw was 22,000 people in Missouri have, the certifications for medical marijuana. That was a number from last month. It's probably even more now. I mean, these people are able, you know, in some cases they can grow it for themselves. They're probably not going to be able to do that right now at this time of year. But I would, assume that there is some frustration among people who are eager to try this out.
How many commercial growers will there be in the state?
There will be 60 for the year 2020.
And isn't there a big fight going on right now when it comes to who's going to get these licenses? What's happening on that front?
Yeah, well, the law limits the number of licenses for different kinds of businesses. So the state has a scoring system that ranks who gets awarded licenses based on things like business experience or having security systems or things like that. And obviously, since medical marijuana is new in Missouri, I mean, most entrepreneurs here don't have nearly the same experience as a lot of, you know, kind of big professionals who might have done this in Colorado or California or someplace like that. So there's a lot of concern right now that the people actually getting these licenses aren't the Missouri business owners who had really been involved with the legalization effort. And so, you know, they think that there's all of these kind of professionals who are just swooping in and grabbing up these licenses, and that you're not going to get these, you know, just kind of hometown people actually making a lot of the money for themselves. There's actually a family in the Springfield area that was really involved in the legalization effort. And I think it was just last week they actually sued the state when they were denied a license for a cultivation facility.
You know, a lot of folks wonder, Dan, that once you've adopted medical marijuana and made that legal, that recreational marijuana is coming right down the pike. Obviously, recreational marijuana now legal in Illinois. I believe the first of the heartland states to legalize recreational marijuana. Would you make that assumption or not?
I would not make that assumption, although we've come a long way over the decades since, you know, marijuana and the government was propagandizing about its, you know, inherent dangers. There are a lot of dangers, to be sure, and there are a lot of studies that need to be undertaken to prove the efficacy of marijuana as a medical, medically helpful. But in Missouri and Kansas, I think it would be a stretch to say that now that we have medical marijuana, at least in Missouri, it's just a glide path to recreational marijuana. Kansas, of course, has yet to approve medical marijuana, so we're a long ways from recreational marijuana in that state. But I dare say in Missouri, too, it would be quite a hurdle to overcome.
Will the legislature consider medical marijuana in Topeka this year? Alex, any feel for that right now?
I think that there's definitely, you know, some interest in that from advocates. Yeah, it's hard to say right now what the legislature's going to do.
Could be a tough sell. Okay, let's move over to vaping. Again, new concerns about the dangers of vaping, health concerns there. There's been some movement both in the courtroom and via efforts from Governor Mike Parson when it comes to vaping and making it tougher for teens to get. Bring us up to speed on that front, Dan.
Yeah, there are a couple of pre-filed bills in the 2020 General Assembly in Missouri that address vaping. One would prohibit people from vaping on school grounds, and another would require schools to include teaching materials about the effects of vaping. You know, we have learned in the last year or so that there are dangers associated with vaping. There have been dozens and dozens of reported deaths associated with vaping across the country, including some in Missouri. So the governor has launched a vaping education campaign, Governor Parson, in November to educate people about the dangers of vaping. Two people have died in Missouri, I believe, in the last year or so, and those deaths have been tied to vaping. But, you know, the problem is in the schools. About a quarter of eighth graders and nearly half of 12th graders have vaped at least once in their life, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And many school districts and many municipalities, of course, have filed lawsuits because they're shouldering the costs of dealing with the fallout from these vaping problems. Those lawsuits have been filed in Missouri and Kansas and elsewhere across the United States. And they're probably looking at the tobacco litigation from 25, 30 years ago as the model. They're hoping that there'll be some kind of global settlement that will force the big makers and marketers of vaping devices, companies like Juul. To pay up and reimburse them for the costs that they, governments and school districts and the like, are incurring.
Speaking of lawsuits, from vaping to yet another health hazard, and that's opioids, lots of lawsuits flying on that front. What's happening in Missouri and Kansas, Dan?
Well, same thing over there. There have been hundreds upon hundreds of lawsuits, thousands of lawsuits across the nation filed in connection with the opioid epidemic. Kansas and Missouri are no exceptions. Municipal bodies have been filing such lawsuits. School districts have been filing such lawsuits. Cities, counties, Jackson County is one of those that have filed lawsuits. All those lawsuits have now, and I think they're well over 1,000, maybe even 2,000, have been consolidated, I believe, in Minneapolis in federal court. And that's where all this is going to be decided.
You know, I don't get the sense that healthcare is going to be a sleepy beat in 2020. Am I hearing that correctly?
I don't think it's ever a sleepy beat. It's certainly not going to be a sleepy beat in 2020.
Okay, that's Dan Margulies and Alex Smith, two reporters from KCUR's healthcare team. And I should point out that KCUR's news staff is presenting this State of Kansas City series as a look ahead to 2020 on topics on a range of importance to the region. You can find the State of Kansas City report on other topics in the series as they're published each weekday between now and January 20th. And then in the meantime, follow coverage on these topics at kcur.org and on 89.3 FM throughout the year for updates on all these important topics. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your time.
Sure,
thank appreciate
you.
It. After a short break, we'll come back and talk about sex scandals in American politics. And yes, there's been a few of them. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. David McCullough, Jim Gaffigan, and Rosalyn Temple are all on my best interviews of the decade list, but you'd know that by now if you subscribe to the up-to-date newsletter. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up now. You'll get my thoughts and highlights from the show each week. That's kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, find out what's on the horizon for the farming industry, including NAFTA, SNAP, and the USDA in KC. It's not all alphabet soup. We'll also discuss flood recovery and farm bankruptcies as we examine all that at the state of agriculture in 2020. Well, in her new book, Avila University professor Leslie Darrow-Smith observes, the public is quick to forgive serial adultery in the cases of certain politicians. But why some politicians and not others? And how do Presidents Trump and Clinton play into all this? Professor Smith joins me now to help us understand this phenomenon. She's an associate professor of religious studies at Avila, director of the Women and Gender Studies program there, and author of Compromising Positions, Sex Scandals, Politics, and American Christianity. Professor, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you point out in this book that Republicans, more so than Democrats, are able to weather the fallout from sex scandals. And I'm wondering, why is that?
Well, that is not always the case, but it often is, in great part because of the type of rhetoric that Republicans are often able to use that appeals to their audiences more readily.
Such as?
Such as what New York Times journalist Maureen Dowd has called red meat moments. Arguments for the superiority of America, arguments that tend to use a lot of hyper-aggressive symbolism. And generally what she sees as masculine moments where politicians are able to say to their audience and to their particular block, we are strong, we're American, we matter.
I can't help but think that President Trump might be someone you're describing there.
Absolutely. One of the interesting things about this book, and I say this in the introduction, is that I actually started writing it before President Trump was ever a candidate. So perhaps I have that to my credit. But he is absolutely the epitome of many of the dynamics that characterize a sex scandal, and specifically a person who tends to weather a sex scandal really, really well.
Why does that kind of tough talk, red meat talk, if you will, why does that talk prove to be so effective for politicians like Donald Trump?
Well, one of the things that I discuss in the book is that there are certain American ideals about who is and who is not, for that matter, eligible to represent us as a nation. And these are very gendered and very raced. And so one of the things that we know is that if you are a politician and you tend to come off as hyper-masculine and even at moments what we could call overly aggressive, you are more likely to win voters at the polls. And so a lot of this has to do with the fact that there's a theory that I use in the book called presidentialism, which is the idea that Americans often confuse their president with the nation itself. So if a president, or let's say any sort of big national political leader, right, for that matter, if a president comes off as a very aggressive, and in some cases even an ads gun-toting person, then we are more likely to see that person as a sign or a symbol of a strong nation. I also mentioned in the book that there have been a couple of very noteworthy and, for some of us, I think, disturbing times when we've had politicians running for office who have acted in violent and aggressive ways, I'm thinking of Greg Gianforte, a representative from the northern U.S. who body slammed a reporter when that reporter asked him a question that he didn't like. Mm-hmm. That hurt Gianforte's ratings in the polls none. In fact, he went on to win political office. So these hyper-masculine aggressive displays of power often go over really well with the American public.
So if you were advising a candidate who gets in hot water because of one type of sex scandal or another, you would tell them to damn the torpedoes full speed ahead and just run at it hard.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that we can find from politicians who have been found guilty in a sex scandal is that those who really weather it very, very well are those who have crafted a very clear public enemy onto which they can focus the public's attention. And they're also ones who themselves can typify that hyper-masculine red meat persona. Mm-hmm. So in other words, to simplify that, if I can come off as a politician as very strong and aggressive, and if I can also point over here in the corner to an enemy, public enemy number one.
In Donald Trump's case, it might be the press.
It could be the press. It could be immigrants. It could be any number of people who he has historically has demonized. Right. Mm-hmm. If I can point to these various groups, and if I can say I, the strong protector, will protect you from these people, then in terms of my social status, I've given myself a pretty big boost.
You know, this may not be part of your book, but what does that say about us? But what does it say about the American electorate writ large that we sort of feel that way and react to these things in such a way?
Well, yeah, I know. what it says is that we're pretty normal, honestly. One of the things that I talk about at some length in the book is that we spend a lot of time in our culture, and for those of us who study religion, we spend a lot of time talking about ethics. And we tend to think of ethics as these things that are eternal and as unchanging, and that they guide us and that they are signs and images of truth. And when in reality, ethics don't work like that for most people in most groups. Ethics are changing. They are often contradictory. They are flexible. And so what it shows us is that it is what social psychologists have been telling us for a really long time about the way that people make ethical decisions, which is that for most of us, we flexibly alter our ethical decisions to fit our current interests at the moment, and then we find some sort of rational excuse to justify that.
Hey, given that, and that's one of the points you do make in the book, this notion of flexibility when it comes to our morals and our ethical values, does that suggest that the way the American people have reacted to sex scandals over time has indeed morphed and evolved?
Yeah, it certainly has. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that we can trace a lot of the shift in sex scandal coverage to really a change in journalistic coverage. So it used to be, and you know, before we had presidents that were appearing on TV and things like this, for instance, you know, we didn't have a lot of Kennedy sex scandal coverage, for instance. But as we get to the 1980s, basically, the 1980s are a really big and important line in the sand for sex scandal coverage. Part of it is that we have the televangelist sex scandals, right? Uh-huh. We've got Jimmy Swaggart, we've got Jim Baker, all sorts of people who are really making quite a splash in these very sensational, over-the-top sexual displays. And this is at the height of the televangelism in the U.S. in general. So we've got, you know, we've got millions of Americans who are tuning in every weekend, and they're sending in millions of dollars to these people. So that's one factor. But the other factor that scholars will often point to is the growth of something called parasocial journalism, which is basically this idea that you and I, as consumers of media, deserve to hear about the private lives of our politicians. Mm-hmm. So some scholars will point to that moment when Bill Clinton played that saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show as one of the moments when Americans of, you know, of a more contemporary era really began to want to see into the private lives of politicians. And so the scholars who study journalistic standards will often say that we have something like a parasocial relational storm in our media when we have they point to a number of factors. One of them is a high number of social conservatives who are very vocal in public. Mm-hmm. And so there tends to be more of a demand for mining into the private lives of a politician. Secondly, is whenever you have a lot of news organizations that perhaps have lower journalistic standards or are willing to I don't think I surprise anyone, you know, by pointing to Fox News here,
right.
who are willing to violate some basic terms of objectivity in order to get the job done, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we can't ignore the fact that we now live in a 24-hour news world.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, Professor, can you point to a politician who got involved in a scandal of one kind or another and simply blew the way he or she handled it and wound up paying the price, either getting forced out of office or losing at the ballot box the next time?
Oh, where to begin?
Yeah.
Well, one that comes to mind, which I think is a really important one to focus on, is Representative Mark Foley from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Foley did, according to how we often understand ethics, Foley did all the right things. Once it became known that he had been sending sexually inappropriate texts to teenage congressional mail pages, once that information became known, Foley very swiftly resigned. He disappeared from the political scene. He did not pursue office again. Now, that seems on the surface to follow what some would consider a very proper ethical channel in the sense that, well, you know, the guy apologized, he removed himself from public life. That seems to be proper. But that is usually what you do if you want to destroy your political career. So Foley is a great example of what to avoid, quite frankly, if a politician wants to survive.
You put him under the label of the cowboy standard. What's the cowboy standard?
Well, I put that label on him as I compare him to Roy Moore, the famous firebrand judge from Alabama. Right? Right. So Roy Moore is, I mean, if you've ever seen Roy Moore, we often know that he rides to the polls on a horse wearing a cowboy hat. So that's a, you know, that label is meant to be quite literal. Roy Moore and Mark Foley are two politicians who I compare in the book because both of them had very similar sex scandals in the sense that both were accused of engaging in pedophilia. Both were accused of specifically highlighting teenagers, and both were also conservatives who spent a lot of time on family values and anti-LGBTQ talk. Now, this becomes super ironic because, of course, we find out later that Mark Foley is himself gay. But one of the reasons why I want to talk about how to measure Mark Foley according to this cowboy standard or the cowboy motif is that there's a lot of evidence that the more that a politician comes off like a cowboy, a white kind of gun-toting, cowboy-wearing guy who's going to subdue the wild, wild west, right? Mm-hmm. And by wild, wild west, I mean, you know, whatever enemies there are out there. The more that a politician can come off like that, if not in Moore's case, a literal cowboy, the more likely he is to survive and weather political sex scandals. So
that gets back to our conversation about Trump that began our conversation here today.
Totally, yeah. Right. Yeah. So Foley failed in almost every regard to fit that cowboy standard.
Do apologists ever come out on top in these things? You apologize, you seem to do the right thing to the people you represent. Does that ever work?
Yeah, sometimes it does.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, but I would say that one of the reasons that it works is because you have a really savvy PR team doing a ton of reputational recovery behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And usually attempting to come up with that enemy we were talking about earlier, and usually attempting to have some more of those red meat moments.
Leslie Darrow Smith is my guest. Her new book, Compromising Positions, Sex Scandals, Politics, and American Christianity. If you want to join our conversation, our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. There's this paradox that you point to here. And the paradox is this, that politicians who appear to steer away from Christian values on the campaign trail wind up being the same people who are most able to win over conservative religious voters. That's just fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. How can that be?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the reasons why I really try to make it clear in the book that I'm interested in studying religion functionally rather than attempting to study its truth claims.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this has to do with the fact that my training is sociological. So I look at religion as a tool that people use in order to negotiate their personal and social relationships. And I'm also interested in thinking about religion as a very strong authority mechanism that can be pulled out and used in a certain circumstance and then put away when it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking more at the effects of religion.
Yeah.
And one of the effects of religion in this particular case is that we know that if you use religious rhetoric in order to describe a sex scandal, then depending on how you deploy that and depending on how you use that, it's a very effective tool to make sure that you can recover your reputation as easily as possible. That doesn't always mean that we use it consistently. And that's one of the things that I say, I think, repeatedly in the book is that humans are inconsistent. And so we should not, if we're thinking about religion as a tool, we shouldn't necessarily expect that politicians are going to use it in a consistent way.
You know, you write that there are circumstances here, and I'm quoting, when the public might read a politician's illicit sex act as something almost patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
Help me there.
Yeah.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, that's another one of those moments where I think it sounds like it's a contradictory statement,
yes.
But there's a lot involved there. What we know, and back to the cowboy motif, right? What we know is that there are certain politicians, and these are some of the folks that I highlight in the book. There are certain politicians who, if they are able to couch their sexual misconduct as simply a matter of boys will be boys or locker room talk. Or I'm thinking of Rudy Giuliani's recent conversation with the media that he didn't need to confess his sexual affairs because he'd already covered it with his priest, right? Mm-hmm. To refuse to address that and to simply brush it under the rug and to say, hey, I don't have to talk to you about that because my job is to be, you know, the father figure protector you need me to be. Many Americans are willing to bypass any sort of sexual misconduct for that purpose. But obviously, of course, it's very much dependent on who you politically support. One of the statistics that I use in the book is that in 2011, during the Obama era, when white evangelicals were polled about whether a politician who was guilty of some sort of personal sin could go on to be a good public leader, only about 30% of white evangelicals said that that was possible. But on the eve of the 2016 election, 72% of the same group said that it would be no problem.
Yeah.
So that's, again, the shifting nature of ethics, right? Our ethics shift is our interest shift. We often overlay a rational veneer in order to get the job done socially, so to speak.
So as we look back at all this and examples that most everyone can recall, how did Bill Clinton weather his scandal while he was in office compared to Donald Trump, whose scandalous behavior, as far as we know, took place prior to him getting into office?
Right. So Bill Clinton is a really tough example. And one of the reasons why is because you can make
a lot of reasons.
And they are reasons that still reverberate today. Bill Clinton, many of his sexual escapades with Paula Jones, who is one of the persons I focus on in the book, happened before he was in the presidential office. He was in the governor's mansion, though. And so on the one hand, we can see that Bill Clinton, like Donald Trump, you know, has a history of philandering. And for those who question whether, by the way, Donald Trump has a history of philandering, Donald Trump has written in his own books about his history of philandering. So this is a matter of public record. But Bill Clinton responded to the news of Paula Jones and Monica Lewinsky in very different ways than Donald Trump has. Now, as far as Jones goes, Clinton still says that he had no form of relationship with Paula Jones, never exposed himself to her. He still denies that. But as many of us remember, he did go on national TV regarding Monica Lewinsky and call their affair sinful. He asked for forgiveness. He followed what we might call a very traditional apology script. On the one hand, he didn't lose his office, right? But the presidential office in that way is pretty protective. It's a really big deal to impeach a president.
As so we're finding out.
Timely conversation, right? Yeah. And so most Americans are simply opposed to impeachment. So I suspect that one of the reasons, honestly, why Bill Clinton kept his office is because he was the president. Had he been someone else, that might not have happened. On the other hand, Donald Trump has refused to apologize. He's very Roy Moore in that sense. He has refused to acknowledge any of the things that he's done to women or said about women as in any way problematic, dismissing them as either things that never happened or as locker room talk.
Because you're getting me as someone who's going to protect you. I'm tough and I'm strong. I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry about it. There might be a few problems on the side.
Right. And there's that cowboy motif where as long as I can come off as the hyper-aggressive masculine protector, then I don't really have to apologize for anything.
Leslie Darrow-Smith is my guest. Her book, Compromising Positions, Sex Scandals, Politics, and American Christianity. You say that sex scandals wind up being about something other than the sex. They're a form of cultural theater, in your words, that create a collective sense of national worth and strength. What are you talking about there?
Yeah. So when I say that sex scandals aren't really about sex, a lot of people, you know, give me a strange look. What are you talking about?
I bet you get a lot of strange looks for some of the ideas you're throwing out here today.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
But in fact, one of the things that I talk about in the classroom with my students is that anytime we're talking about the topic of sex, we're usually talking about something else.
Mm-hmm.
So sex is usually, you know, although we think about it as something that we do with our bodies, right? The conversations surrounding sex are usually about power and alliances. Who can get together with who? Who can form a relationship and make a family? who is seen as an acceptable human and who is not. So historically, over time, a lot of the ways in which, you know, if you think about the really controversial social issues that we've faced, you know, over the past several decades, things like LGBTQ rights, things like abortion, things even like access to contraception, even back to the 1970s, things like, you know, divorce law. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. And how does it, you know, how does it take shape? All of these things are really about, at their core, who can align with other people in sexual relationships. So conversations about sex are usually about something else.
Huh. I can't say I'm surprised by this, but you say there was a very large pool of candidates to study for this book. How did you wind up narrowing the list?
Yeah, it was a crushing pool, in fact. So I narrowed the list down to several different qualities that I needed to have at hand in order just to make the project manageable.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that I decided to do was to look only at male politicians. As a gender studies professor, that might come off as a little bit of an odd choice for me to make, but there's an absolute rationale behind it. There are very few female politicians who have engaged in a sex scandal, first of all. And secondly, there are almost no female politicians who have engaged in a sex scandal who have survived.
Hmm.
So there are reasons for that, and the book lays them out amply, which is basically that part of how we understand American masculinity is through sexuality. You know, when we think about what a red-blooded American man is supposed to be, we think about his libido. We think about his prowess.
Right.
And so part of that has to do with the ways that we simply understand who gets to count as a powerful figure. And so that's why I chose men. The second factor that I was looking at was someone who had some national notoriety. The more national notoriety you have, you know, these were obviously factors in just determining what a readership would like to hear about in a book. But more than that, the more widespread that the coverage was of the politician in question, the more likely there was to be a lot of different commentaries going on that would allow us to see how many aspects of the American public had responded.
That's interesting. A focus throughout this book, Compromising Positions, is how these scandals center around the issues of sex, gender, and race. And you've mentioned that here, Leslie. You spent time talking about Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, and then you've mentioned Paula Jones and Bill Clinton. Let's start with Professor Hill. What are the stereotypical ideas that undermined her testimony, you know, in the eyes and ears of those who supported the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court?
So Anita Hill strikes me as one of the most interesting characters in this book, and I end up invoking her again in the epilogue, where I compare the Hill-Thomas testimony to the Kavanaugh-Ford testimony that we just recently heard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about Anita Hill, and this is for those who weren't there, we're talking the early 90s, now 91. One of the interesting things about Anita Hill is that she is an African-American woman who is a person of a strong and solid reputation who is speaking out against another African-American, Clarence Thomas,
right,
who's the nominee for the Supreme Court at the time. And what is fascinating and really, from an ethical perspective, I suppose, disturbing to watch was what ended up happening to Hill and the ways in which her testimony was denigrated. But it's interesting to watch because it reverberates with many other women who find themselves in this particular boat. Anita Hill was characterized by activist and writer David Brock, not to be confused with New York Times writer David Brooks. This is
right.
David Brock,
mm-hmm.
Then conservative writer. He wrote a book called The Real Anita Hill. Some of us may remember that. And he described her as a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. Those are his words.
Mm-hmm.
And what Brock described in that nutty but slutty line is really a microcosm of what ended up going on at the testimony. On the one hand, there was a group of people who said that Senator John Danforth was actually one of the ones who pegged this term. He called Anita Hill an erotomaniac. He alleged that she was an obsessed groupie who was sexually infatuated with Clarence Thomas. And whenever Thomas rejected her, this is why she decided to come up with these allegations. Senator Orrin Hatch is famous for bringing a copy of the book The Exorcist to that testimony and reading part of this book because he believed that part of Hill's testimony was very similar to a passage from the book, and he thought
wow.
that she'd lifted it from the text. So
right.
that's the slutty camp, if we're using Brock's nutty but slutty. the nutty camp, if we can call it that, is the hordes of male politicians who demanded that Hill voice what exactly it was that had happened to her that was so wrong. Mm-hmm. Alan Simpson is famous for demanding on the podium that she point out exactly how she got hurt. If Thomas did say these things to her, Hatch described her as being held hostage to a liberal feminist agenda. And so we have on the one hand this assessment that she is a hypersexualized woman gone crazy. And on the other hand, we've got this idea that she's a liberal feminist gone rogue who doesn't know how to handle, as we've used the phrase now again, locker room talk. So the attack against Hill came from both angles.
And how about Clarence Thomas then? How was he portrayed in these hearings?
Well, race and gender are absolutely at the cusp of what's going on in these hearings because Thomas's most famous lines is that he described the attacks from Hill as a high-tech lynching.
Yes, I remember.
And he goes on to say that it's a high-tech lynching of black men for imagined sexual offenses. So one of the things that Anita Hill remarks here is that the Thomas testimony became something about his race and her gender. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to put it because when we have two black Americans whose voices are raging against each other, and when we have a Republican constituency that very much wants to see a black Supreme Court justice in place in order to, you know, to speak to its own concerns for diversity, it's easy to see from a symbolic perspective that Anita Hill was probably a goner from the start.
I was going to say, in this instance, male conservatives seem to trump black and hypersexual.
Yeah, I would say that male and conservative and hypersexual altogether trump black, mm-hmm. because I think most Americans politically have been pretty comfortable with male and political and hypersexual. It's the black that hasn't been so comfortable. But when you have Anita Hill's African-American voice against Clarence Thomas's, the question came down to, as she would later say, he said, she said. So mm-hmm. this is one of the interesting things. You know, Joe Biden in the past few months has actually reached out to Anita Hill to apologize for the way that he ran those hearings back in the early 90s. And Hill's response has been very interesting to watch because she still stands by the idea that what happened there was a case of misogyny.
Hmm. Well, she's been on this show before mm-hmm. making that very case. How did you get that? We have 30 seconds left. How did you get involved in writing about sex scandals, politics, and American Christianity? Again, that's biting off a pretty big piece of the apple there.
Yeah, only the controversial things is what I'll write about. Right. My career has been scholarship of evangelicalism and sex, gender, and reproduction policy. Mm-hmm. So these are factors that have been interesting to me for a long time. And my first book was about conservative women's groups and their political advocacy in the U.S. So when I began to sort of watch the way that a lot of sex scandals took place and the way that religion got deployed and then revoked, and when I began to use, again, that kind of functional sense to ask how religion is being used, sex scandals seemed the obvious place to start. And I mean, let's be honest, it's also really hard to ignore, you know, people like Anthony Weiner. And you can't write this stuff most of the time,
that's,
right?
You can't make truth. It up. That's Leslie Darrell Smith. Again, her new book, Compromising Positions, Sex Scandals, Politics, and American Christianity. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your views. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, after a really tough year for Midwest farmers and ranchers, we'll look ahead to what agricultural issues that KCUR will be following in 2020. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.